Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to This is the Place, a podcast series from The Common magazine on the New Books Network. The Common publishes literature and art with a modern sense of place. I'm Emily Everett, managing editor of the magazine and host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Leo Rios about his story, Lencho, which appears in the most recent issue of The Common in a portfolio of writing from the immigrant farmworker community. Originally from the Central Valley of California, Leo Rios studied English at UCLA and received an MFA from Cornell University. His first published story was selected by ZZ Packer as winner of the Arkansas International's Emerging Writers Prize. His second published story appeared in the Georgia Review and was noted as a distinguished story in the Best American Short Stories 2022. Other publications include Stories in the Rumpus, The Masters Review, and Joyland Magazine. A recent recipient of a McDowell Fellowship, he currently lives in Tucson, Arizona, where he teaches writing at the University of Arizona. Leo Rios, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Emily. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Would you set the scene for our conversation? Just describe where you're calling from now.
Sure thing. I am here in Tucson, Arizona, where it is sunny, though it rained all night.
I bet it's a little warmer than where I am. I think we're probably at 20 degrees right now.
It is. I feel very lucky every day. The cold is somewhat of a nuisance in the morning, but then it kind of goes away. And then it's like, yes, this is awesome.
That sounds good. I would love to start off with a reading from your story. Would you read the first few paragraphs for us?
Sure thing. here is the beginning of the story, Lencho. Good vibes started at Movida, my favorite bicycle club in Bakersfield, because it was real. Other clubs were only restaurants during the day or warehouses on the fairgrounds. Movida was a big-time deal, built especially for visiting artists who came from everywhere, LA, Mexico, sometimes Central or South America. It was the dance spot you took your girl to, if you wanted to be among the best dressed, the most beautiful. All week, the radio stations announced the club's Valentine's Day promotions. For that Friday, they'd booked Viento de Oro, a banda that had recently toured with John Sebastian. His name alone was enough to convince us that the whole thing was urgent. Didn't matter that the fool himself wouldn't be there. In the rural towns of North Kern County where we lived, tickets were sold at La Canasta Meat Market in Wasco, Tres Hermanos CD store in McFarland, and the State Farm Insurance Office in Delano. I bought ours at La Canasta. The night of the dance, my friend Lencho drove us the 30 miles from Wasco to Bakersfield. It was me, him, plus two girls, Liz and Sam. They were juniors, a year younger. I had never actually talked to them before. In the car Lencho had stolen from his sister, we all swallowed vodka flavored like syrup. Walking slow in the parking lot afterward, Liz and I linked arms and huddled. Her curly hair brushed against my shoulder, and she felt so soft against my bicep. I wanted to have a dance with her right then and there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for reading that. For our listeners who may not have read your story yet, would you describe what the piece is about?
Sure. So it's basically about a group of teenagers, high schoolers, who go to a dance in Bakersfield, and they travel from their small town called Wasco to the city of Bakersfield, which is in the Central Valley of California, about an hour and a half to 2 hours north of LA. And at the club, they dance, they drink, they dance, they party, they have fun. And then afterward, on their way back to their hometown, they have to drive through a long patch of road where there are almond orchards, and Lencho ends up taking them into an almond orchard where there's an abandoned house, and sort of the scene turns shadowy, and what happens at the house is a little, different than what the beginning of the story was, was about. So in a way, the narrator is sort of thrust into a situation that he didn't expect with Lencho and the two other girls who they're with. So I don't want to spoil it too much, but long story short, they go to a party and then there's an after party.
Yes, an unexpected after party. That's great. Well, what inspired you to start work on this piece? Like, how did that first draft come together? I know from talking to you that it was quite a long time ago.
Yeah, and you know what? I haven't ever told anybody this, but I'm happy to share that last year, almost exactly a year ago, a story called Now or Never was published in the Master's Review. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of that story, there's a guy in LA who's locked out of his apartment. And I started writing a backstory, and the backstory was that the guy had gone to a baile, a dance, and there had been a fight. And there was something about violence in the story and how he was sort of afraid of violence and, this fight on the dance floor. So I was writing a fight scene on the dance floor. And because I was describing bodies moving through space, the fighting turned into dancing. And all of a sudden I found that I was writing a dance scene, and it was the dance scene between Liz, one of the female characters, and the narrator. And I loved it. I really love the writing and the scene, and describing dancing, which I have a background in dancing. And the story sort of developed from there. I had to sort of build the beginning of the story under that premise that they were at least two characters were at a dance, a dance club. Mm-hmm. And so that's really how it started. Was I was in graduate school and I had to write a story for workshop, and I was working on this one story, and then the dancing sort of splintered and branched off and became its own story, which I think is super cool. I like to think about it from a writing point of view, that you're like trying to describe a fight scene, but because like bodies and arms and legs are sort of like moving, it naturally turns into a dance. Well, it did for me at least. And I love that. I love that it happened like that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That scene is so great. That sort of opening scene when they're dancing at the club, there's moments where the music is building and people are sort of going into almost kind of a frenzy when they're dancing. It's so high energy. Yeah, I definitely could see the line between fighting and dancing being a little blurry there.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I don't know if, I mentioned that there's sort of a turn when they go to the almond orchard, and that sort of emerged after later having a conversation with a friend of mine about sex and sexuality and the way it was sort of policed in the area that I grew up in. But maybe we can, I don't know if you want to talk about that now or save it for like a later part of the conversation.
It's totally up to you.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hold on to it. I think for right now we can talk about the beginning, and okay. I'm sure the rest of the content will sort of come up naturally, I feel.
Sure. So I'm thinking, when I read this piece, when you first submitted it to the Common, it was one of the first pieces that came in when we put out our call for submission for work writing from the farm worker community. And I think what struck me most when I first read it was the language and the energy of it. You know, sort of, we were just talking about that dance scene that's really high energy, and the narration itself is really lively. It feels really honest to these characters and the way they live and their time in life. It feels young. Did that come pretty naturally, or was it something you worked at and refined? Like, did it take you a while to find that voice, or was that voice just pretty natural to that scene?
I think it's a voice that I had been playing around with for a while, but the voice belonged to an older narrator, a 24-year-old narrator who was living in Los Angeles, and there was something sort of grungy about this character, and so that's kind of where I think the voice, I was playing around with it, and also I think during the time that I was writing it, I had like a child's voice that I was playing around with, and then like an older, like more kind of adolescent or young adult voice. And this is that voice of that character. But, you know, the reality is that at the time I was in graduate school and I had to take a bunch of classes and they had this series of classes for us in the MFA program called Reading for Writers. And it was cool. You know, I took the first one. And then the second semester, it was actually, one that was taught that focused on fiction, and they were going to read like 5 or 6 like books, you know, all fiction, and it was going to be solely, you know, focused on fiction. And I don't even know why, but I decided to drop in on a different reading for writers that was actually called Reading for Poets with Alice Fulton, who's one of the faculty members there at Cornell. And I showed up to the first day of class and I loved it. And I stayed in the class, even though it was a undergraduate upper division class. We were allowed to take upper division undergraduate courses. So I was there in the class with a few. There was one other graduate student, another MFA poet, and then Alice, and then a few undergrads. And we read contemporary poetry. She chose 6 collections. Juan Felipe Herrera was one of them.
Okay.
He was poet laureate of the United States at the time. And we just kind of met once a week and talked about poetry. And it was the first time since undergrad when I was reading, you know, Percy Shelley and, you know, Shakespeare and
yeah.
You know, Lord Byron and, you know, all the stuff that I had to read for my classes. It was the first time I had read contemporary poetry in a long time. So I loved it and I got really into it, and it sort of changed me the way I wrote, definitely. So I think it was during this time that that I was reading poetry that I also wrote this story, The Beginning, and I think it sort of influenced me. I mean, not consciously. I wasn't sitting there like thinking that I needed to, you know, write poetry, but it's just because I was reading poetry, it sort of kind of, I think, influenced the way I built the sentences as lines. And even the first paragraph has that, you know, built especially for visiting artists who came from everywhere. There's a line in Juan Felipe Herrera's collection where he says something along the lines of, because we come from everywhere or something like that. And at the end of the class that semester, Alice actually brought in a cake. And the cake said, we come from everywhere or something along those lines.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, there are little things like that that I was kind of playing around with. And I had a lot of fun and I enjoyed sort of crafting sentences that to me, at least to me in my very rudimentary, like, I'm not a poet, but I want to like include a few lines here and there, you know, like so soft. And, you know, when... when he says, I wanted to have a dance with her right then and there. And then later the characters say here now. And, you know, there's just little like to me, what to me are like inside jokes that are kind of built into the language.
Oh, I love that.
And so I think that's one of the reasons why the fighting turned into dancing, because I had sort of softened in my, just in my whole person, my life, my personality. And I just really opened to poetry in a way that to me was life changing. That class totally changed me, and I didn't expect to take a class that would sort of impact me so profoundly. I mean, I just wanted to kind of get by and get through my classes and focus on my writing. But to this day, I find that reading poetry sort of gets me going in the way that nothing else does. I mean, I love reading short fiction and novels, but when I read poetry, it's just, I think because I come to it as a beginner, you know, I don't presume to be a poet, so I have to read very attentively. It sort of just gets me going, and it just really stimulates me, and it's just the whole, it was just a whole new sort of a development in my reading and writing. So I think that's kind of where the sort of, if there's any lyricism, you know, to be said in the piece. And then also, even before that, well, I guess before that, I listened to a lot of hip hop. And when I first started writing, I think hip hop was kind of like part of that too. But then it kind of changed. I think it got upgraded to like poetry, like contemporary poetry that I was reading. So, so long story short, Alice Fulton's class just completely like rocked me and leveled me and upgraded my sensibilities. I think it's, you know, I can't say enough good things about that class and how beautiful it was and how life-changing it was.
Oh, that's great. That's really interesting to hear. And I think it leads well into my next question. You know, you're talking about softening things and fighting, turning to dancing and stuff. But I was thinking about the two main characters, the narrator and Lencho, are football players. And it's a big part of their identity. And we usually think of football as like a very masculine sport. But in this story, it is very masculine, but it also seems to make some space for maybe a more queer experience, or the players, you know, just knowing each other really intimately and lines getting blurred. And with Lencho, it seems to be that football is like a way to be violent with other men, but also a way to be close to them and to build this friendship. Would you just talk a little bit about that?
You know, I think the first thing that comes to mind is just all the guys that I grew up with throughout like middle school and high school playing football. I myself, you know, played football and, you know, went to dances and, you know, went to, you know, parties where it was like guys drinking and smoking. And then later in college, I was in a Latino fraternity, which I joined my freshman year sort of spontaneously. At the same time, I was part of a dance group, a folklorico dance group, which is Mexican folk dance. So I had these two experiences of like what might be considered like a masculine, you know, the masculine space, and then a more like feminine space. So I felt like in me, I was very lucky in college to have these both sort of expressions of myself. And I think when they come to the fraternity, more than anything, I observed a hardness that would sometimes soften into intimacy or vulnerability. And I think a lot of those guys, including myself, were walking around with all of these feelings that rarely sort of kind of made it out into open space. And I know that was true of like the guys I grew up with in high school. I remember once I was at a party and we were drinking and, you know, smoking, and there was this guy and he was like really big, and everyone, you know, he kind of got made fun of a lot. And at one point he was this huge, like just huge guy, you know, he was just 100% like just muscle, and just, he was just big boned, as they say, you know? And at one point he just broke down crying, and he was like, "You guys don't understand, like people have been making fun of me my whole life." And it was just, to see that happening was, I think, sort of representative of what everyone was sort of kind of going through. So I think despite the masculinity and the hardness, I sort of sensed that there was something sort of softer or more intimate about these people that I grew up with. And so I wondered, like, what would it be like if we were allowed to sort of express that and actually like love each other in a way that, you know, that might turn romantic or some kind of maybe love that, you know, I can't even put words to, but I guess maybe a type of love for in between like guys, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Guys who are used to like hitting each other, and, you know, at practice you inflict violence upon each other, but then at the same time, like, I think a lot of us just wanted to hold each other sometimes, you know, and I think we weren't allowed to do that. Or if we did, it was like in joking, you know, like we would act out like, you know, intimacy, but it was more of a joke. And I wondered if everyone was just kind of walking around with like real love for each other. And so I kind of wondered about that. So I think it's a type of, to me, like love story that often isn't, it's kind of policed, you know. And I think in the very conservative, you know, Kern County that I grew up in, something like that, you know, like Lencho and the narrator, even exploring the possibility of a type of romantic love, a queer love, mm-hmm. like that's just so transgressive and so like difficult. But I think that intimacy is real and it's there. And I think it cannot be silenced. It cannot be stopped. So, and I have felt that, I think, you know, growing up and even in college, just feeling that vulnerability, that intimacy between guys, that, you know, that it was okay to be like that with a woman, you know, to be like that with a girlfriend, you know, mm-hmm. like you could be vulnerable. And, but among guys, you kind of had to be kind of hard. And I knew these guys who were like supposedly hard, and then I would see them sort of break down at times and cry. And I was like, you know, I was just, I just really kind of feel that dilemma of like having all these feelings and not being able to express them, and how sad it is that the possibility of romantic love can be kind of squashed mm-hmm. By the circumstances. So all of that to say that, you know, the narrator and Lencho sort of explore the possibility of romantic love. And I think that's very normal to me, you know? So, I think I just feel like that is very normal for these guys to have these kinds of experiences.
Yeah, it's interesting. They are so intimate as friends, and then they know their bodies so well because they play football together that it does feel natural. And, you know, obviously there's, you know, you still feel that maybe the societal pressure, the what would people think, but it feels, I think, to them kind of natural. Yeah. I said before that you had submitted this work as part of our form worker portfolio. And I, you know, there's a few like hints about farm working in this story that Lencho, maybe that's his future, is working on farms because he's probably not going to college. I wonder if you could just tell us a little more about your background with farm work, either personally or in your family.
Yeah, of course. Now, well, it all begins with my grandpa, Serafin, who immigrated from Mexico to the Delano area of California, which was, you know, north of Bakersfield. And he did this because Delano, California, and my parents' hometown in Michoacán, I remember learning in Chicano studies classes that there are like these binational communities where people go to a certain place in the U.S. and then a lot of other people go there. And then so, like, for example, when I would go to Mexico during like Christmas growing up, I would meet a lot of people from Delano. And so there's this story about how there's a lot of people from my parents' hometown in Delano. And that's how my grandpa ended up in Delano, though. There's a beautiful story about him going to Sinaloa, which is a Western state in Mexico, mm-hmm. and trying to get recruited by these U.S. contractors. And while he waited to try to get a U.S. contract, he sold aguas frescas, you know, waters, you know, like Jamaica, horchata. And so that's kind of funny because my grandpa was also, you know, speaking of hardness, he was sort of a rigid man and, you know, very kind of stoic. So that's how it started. He came here and he worked in the fields until he was physically no longer able to. Wow. And, you know, by extension, his children, my uncles, also worked in the fields. My own parents worked in the fields. My dad, since he was like basically a child, both in Mexico and in the U.S., he worked in the fields grafting roses. And cool. I think that was like one of the main stories that he tells is like grafting roses, because he said he loved it. He said he would do it out of joy and pleasure, that he enjoyed the work when he was a young man.
That's
and That's then, nice. Yeah, yeah, it's, it was, you know, it was part of the family. Just, it was just kind of reality growing up that our parents and my uncles and a lot of people in town that they worked in the fields. That was kind of what people did. And then I love this. There's this like myth, this family myth about how my parents were approached in the fields by an organization that provided like ESL classes and GED classes to farm mm-hmm. workers. And my parents at the time, you know, they tell stories of having, you know, they had us four. I have four brothers total, nothing but brothers. Oh, that's something we might have maybe should have talked about when we were talking about masculinity. The fact that I have four brothers and no sisters. But anyways, they tell stories of like looking in the couches for coins in order to buy food because, you know, they weren't making enough money in the fields. And so they decided to take a risk and, you know, they had to take time off to go to these classes, but eventually they got their GEDs and then my mom got a job in the clinic as a medical records clerk mm-hmm. and my dad at the same company, where he was grafting roses, he got a job as a maintenance mechanic. So he was like fixing machines and kind of working on the grounds and then basically they stopped working in the fields and they kept those jobs for as long as they could. My mom to this day still works in that same job, same position.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. She got that one job and she was like, she just kind of stayed there. My dad later worked in the oil fields, which is another industry that's in the area. I love that story because I don't know why they never really harped on it too much, but to me, it always like encouraged me to like go to school and like focus mm-hmm. on school. And it was like my parents, you know, they got their GEDs. And I remember I was in fourth grade and on the standardized testing form, it asked your parents like highest level of education. And I was mm-hmm. so proud that my parents had gotten their GEDs. Mm-hmm. And I remember asking the teacher like, oh, like what about a GED? Like, is that college or some college?
Right.
And she was like, oh, no, you could put high school. And then so that to me made me want to go to college because I was like, well, the next step after a GED yeah. is college, because I think the next one was like some college. Mm-hmm. So it always like I wanted to go to college because I had this myth was like in my body and I don't know why it like motivated me so much. So that's what happened with mm-hmm. my parents. As for me, I worked on my uncle's ranch. He had a ranch and I worked there, one summer, you know, feeding animals and, you know, cutting down corn stalks, but mm-hmm. it was with family, you know, so it wasn't, right. you know, I didn't have a foreman or anything
right.
like that. So, but then as there's a story in the, you know, about, going into the fields and bariando, you get these long bamboo sticks and you have to knock down the almond pods. Me and one of my cousins, one winter break, we did that work, but we got fired after one day. We were not good at it, you know. We were not good at it. We were slow, you know, and yeah. it was our first time out there. And
it is really skilled labor, I think.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
a feeling that it isn't, and I know now that that is so incorrect.
Oh man, some of these guys, you know, they just go through these fields and they're just going really fast, and then after, so that didn't last long, but I worked at Kmart. It was the biggest store in town. And my graduation week of high school, I quit because I wanted to go to a party. So I called in and I was like, I quit, you know, I'm not coming in anymore. And at the time I knew that I was going to go to UCLA. So I was like, I don't care. You know, I was like 17, 18, right? So, but then I was like, damn, I need money. So I actually ended up working on a farm that was owned by one of my football teammates' dad, actually. Mm-hmm. So I was on a crew hoeing weeds in almond orchards, and the almond trees were like young. So the roots mm-hmm. were like super, super thick, and my shoulder just like got numb. My whole arm, the mm-hmm. whole right side of my body just was like numb, and the guys had to keep helping me. And I remember at one point a plane flew overhead and the guys were like, oh, it's our boss. You know, he's keeping tabs on us. So I think one of the reasons why these guys were working so hard is out of fear of like losing their jobs, you know, like if they didn't work hard enough that they were going to be dismissed, just like I was, you know, for being too slow. Like if you don't cut it out there, they get rid of you and then somebody else is going to replace you quick. So, so I did that for that summer, and part of it was symbolic. You know, I wanted to know what it was like to like be, you know, work in the fields because I had grown up there. My parents had done it, but then they always kind of shielded us from it. You know, like they didn't want us to work in the fields. They wanted us to focus on school, you know, and I remember even going out there and working in the fields, and the older guys were like, "What are you doing here?" And I'm like, "I'm working." And they're like, "How old are you?" And, you know, "I'm 17. Like, why aren't you in school?" And then I would explain to them and they would tell me like, "You need to go to school because this work ain't worth shit." You know, they would tell me things like that, like really sad stories about like how they had no choice but to do this work. And they were trying to encourage me to go to school because it seemed like I had an option. I had a choice that I had an opportunity to go to school that they didn't, you know, so. You know, there's all these, you know, stories about, you know, farm work and working out in the fields. But it sort of kind of became a thing of the past once I went to college and lived in L.A. But even then, I took it with me because people would ask me where I'm from and I would tell them and they'd be like, "Oh, Cowtown, you know, the middle of nowhere." It's like, okay, like that's rude, you know, like. Yeah. So I would always be judged because I came from like a small rural town. And even though I was over here at UCLA, they were kind of mean about it sometimes, which kind of annoyed me, but it is where I'm from. And now I'm very proud of being where I'm from. And, you know, Manuel Munoz, the short story writer and novelist who teaches here at the University of Arizona, he just got a MacArthur Genius Grant, you know, and he writes a lot about farm workers. And I say he's a champion. He's a champion of the Central Valley. And so it's very inspiring, you know, to see somebody like him writing about these communities and me also kind of being from a community similar to the one that he grew up in. It makes me feel really encouraged. So I love it. I love the people that, you know, I got to know growing up. And I think at one point, because of what I mentioned about people judging me, I used to be a little ashamed of it, you know. But I think now I like to just accept it and embrace that, you know, this is kind of how I grew up and I'm more interested in like bearing witness to the reality than I am to sort of distorting the truth of where I come from. So, those are some of the stories of, you know, farm work in my life.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. A thing that I have learned from working on this farm worker portfolio with Miguel M. Morales, who is our co-editor for the portfolio, is that how hard it is to find other farm workers who are writing and how hard it is to kind of find community with people with that background. I think because people do kind of keep it quiet. And it's just, I sort of love that you studied at Cornell, where Helena Maria Viramontes teaches, and she's a legend of writing about her farm working background, and then also working with Manuel Munoz as well. I love that you've found your little farm worker community in the writing world.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I wrote my undergraduate thesis on Helena Maria Viramontes's Under the Feet of Jesus, and I did a whole thing about farm worker fiction. And, you know, reading these farm worker stories, you know, so like Tomas Rivera, and the earth did not devour him. And like the playwright Luis Valdez and even Juan Felipe Herrera, Tim Z. Hernandez. But especially Helena, you know, when I read her work, and it made me want to write, you know, it's like, oh, I have stories too, you know, like I also have stories and I come from this area. And so it really sort of motivated me to want to write as an undergrad, but yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. My farming background is just that I grew up on my parents' farm, which is certainly very different, but I think for a while I thought that that those stories weren't worth telling, like that they weren't cool and modern. And over time, I've really come to found that people are very curious about it, and that I'm not ashamed of it or anything. And I just, I think my writing does end up heading in that direction a lot, and I like it. Yeah.
At the same time, I love the descriptions of farm work, and but I think I've always had some kind of like contrarian or kind of rebel, you know, sensibility where I'm like, yeah, but yes, you know, it's true. Like, it's very noble and noble work, and it's very hard work, and there's a lot of injustice. But at the same time, these people, you know, people I grew up with, people I knew, like, they were human, and some of them were out in the field smoking pot or popping pills, you know? And yeah. It was like, there is like, I don't want to like romanticize, you know, the farm worker, because I think there's more to the experience, especially among my generation, you know, of people that who especially, you know, younger people who might be, you know, farm workers, but at the same time, they want to go party, you know, they want to go dance, they want to, you know, have romantic love. So there's, I feel like, you know, many layers to the experience of being a farm worker that I'm interested in.
Yeah, that's great. So, always the last thing we ask a podcast guest is sort of what they're working on now. And I'm thinking that the last time we spoke on the phone, you were at McDowell, doing a residency, and you were doing the final revisions on this piece, and maybe you were like finishing a story collection. Is that true?
I think I was finishing a draft of a story collection. I did finish a draft, and I sort of had that dilemma. I don't know if we talked about this when I was at McDowell, but McDowell, I had that dilemma, is like, am I done with short stories? Mm. Do I need to start writing a novel? Like, so I felt very split, and I think a part of me wanted to be done with short stories, but I don't think I am. I think you know, when I first started writing, back in 2012, you know, over 10 years ago, I was like, oh, I'll just write a, you know, loosely autobiographical short story collection, like kind of like Victor Laval did with Slapboxing with Jesus. Okay, no big deal. I'll bang that out, and then I'll write a novel. And I thought it was going to be like easy, you know, but I have found that, you know, apprenticing in the short story has been grueling and very demanding. And, and I sort of, when I was at McDowell, I kind of wanted to like escape or run away from it. Mm. But since coming back, I feel like I want to double down and finish a short story collection that I think can be very robust. I want to, you know, I want it to be, you know, I want it to be as good as I think I can make it. So I am for now not getting ahead of myself by saying that I'm writing a novel, though I do have a few, you know, stuff that are kind of on the back burners. But I think right now, for the next foreseeable future, I am going to focus on trying to finish my short story collection. Several of the stories have been, you know, published already, and I have several more that I want to sort of include. And I just want it to be like a full length, you know, collection that can sort of sit on the shelves, you know, with other story collections that I admire. So long story short, I'm still working on short stories, though I did almost refuse the call, you know, to continue. But I can't help it. I want to finish my work. And for whatever reason, the short story has sort of kind of, you know, become my home in a way. So I want to keep going, even though, you know, people say like, people say like, oh, short stories don't sell. And, you know, editors don't really want short stories. And I'm like, well, I beg to differ. I have found people who actually disagree with those kinds of statements. So I'm going to continue working on short stories.
Yeah. I think there's always going to be space for good short stories. And you've written so many of them already. Might as well stick it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a few things on the back burner. I mean, that's the best way to do it, you know?
Yeah. Cause you know, everyone's like, oh, that's cool, short stories, but what's your novel about? You know, and it's like, you know, like, I don't know. Even, I don't know. I think I feel more comfortable as a reader, even as a reader reading short stories and poetry, because they're more, to me, more manageable. And in a novel, it's just so long, you know, and it's, maybe I need to just sit down and spend 6 hours reading a whole novel in one sitting or something. Maybe that'll make it, you know, better. But I like that with the short story, you can sit down and in one sitting, you can sort of experience the whole story. And then afterward, you're like, whoa.
Yeah, sort of reeling from it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I need to take a break, you know.
Yeah. Well, Leo Rios, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really great to talk with you. I'm so glad we got to talk today.
Thank you, Emily. This was great. I'm super grateful for the magazine, for the portfolio, to Miguel. You know, this has been my most exciting like publication, and I love the cover, you know, the pink cover. If you guys, whoever's listening, if you don't have, you know, the issue, it is a beautiful pink cover with a tool. Is a, what is it? A turnip?
It's a turnip. Yeah.
It's a turnip. And I just love, I have really loved not only, you know, working on the story, but also like seeing it through the publication and then enjoying, you know, the fact that it's published now. So thank you, Emily, and thank you everyone at the Common and all the readers and everyone listening right now.
Well, that's really nice to hear. You know, I've been at the Common for 7, almost 8 years and published a lot of issues. And this one was very, very special. The community between the contributors and the excitement around the magazine coming out and these stories being told has just been absolutely magical to be a part of. Like, I just feel so lucky to be part of it, to be making it happen.
Yes, 100%.
Listeners, you can read Leo's story, Lencho, and subscribe to the latest issue at thecommononline.org.